more than 120 heads of state will meet next week in New York for the UN Climate Summit, the largest gathering of world leaders ever on climate. But before that, on Sunday, up to 100,000 climate change activists, from environmentalists to faith groups to labor groups, plan to march through Manhattan in one of the largest ever climate demonstrations to send a message to those leaders. Karthikeya Singh is a researcher with the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts. He's also worked on climate negotiations, including consulting for the waterlogged Maldives. And Karthikeya, you write about a line that you overheard at a particularly heated negotiation. It had to do with the text of an agreement that was being proposed. And someone said, if we accept this text, we are killing ourselves. Tell us more about that and how that informed you.
Yeah, that was actually one of the final meetings at the Durban climate change negotiations back in 2012. And it was really coming down to what sort of framework is acceptable to the Association of Small Island States. And it was not seeming fair to many members of that grouping and did not seem ambitious enough. And rightly so. We are not at a place where we can say that the climate will stabilize to below 2 degrees, which scientists believe will be safer for life on our planet. And so accepting any text that looked like it was going to far overshoot this would threaten essentially the livelihoods and the sovereignty of many of these small island states.
Well, in their very existence, some people might
Absolutely.
Remember, when the Maldives president held a cabinet meeting underwater.
That is correct. And that was intended to send precisely that kind of message, that this is not just about making political statements at an international level and declarations that will not be met and that governments must deliver in earnest. Otherwise, literally, nations will be wiped out and we'll have climate refugees. And where will they go?
Well, and now you train diplomats from countries who participate in these climate negotiations. What do you tell them?
In the trainings that I have been involved in, there are very specific roles that I have played in the past. And one is sort of what are the options technologically to address the issue? And then the other side of it, the more nitty-gritty of the negotiations that I can most recently speak to from my experience of training in Qatar prior to the negotiations that happened there, was how to navigate the complex negotiating process, particularly for first-time diplomats who are engaging in what is a decades-long process that is incredibly complex. I mean, we're talking about you arrive at a negotiation, there's various working groups late into the night, negotiation happening both formally and informally, where to get your documents, how to leverage social media and civil society. These are the kinds of things that I was able to contribute in the trainings to first-time diplomats based on my own various experiences, both as an academic and as an activist and also as a negotiator in the process.
So those are perhaps thoughts ahead of the meeting of heads of state on Tuesday, but you're also heading to the demonstration on Sunday. What point do you want to get across there?
I want to go primarily because many social movements have big moments of gathering, of turning points. You know, recently the Yale Project on Climate Communication released a survey of registered voters in the United States about how many of them would be willing to vote for candidates that support climate change legislation. And given that we even have elections coming up in this country, the importance of such gatherings in sending a signal to politicians that we are watching. We do care about this as an important issue. Of course, the economy matters and other matters of global diplomacy and security do matter, but climate change is a security issue. And so I want to go and witness what I believe will be a historic event and that can be a turning point towards informing politicians that this is an important issue that they should focus on. And of course, I'm going representing many different voices. The voice of the Indian Youth Climate Network that I, along with others, founded back in March 2008 while I was living in India, and various other groups that cannot be here.
You say you want to fly the Indian flag. Remind us what's at stake for India.
Well, India is, according to certain vulnerability indexes that are coming out, one of the most vulnerable. The monsoon, which India relies so heavily on, is becoming increasingly erratic. And the entire nation and the region's water supply depends on this annual event. And with it becoming threatened, the livelihoods of hundreds of millions of people is on the line. And at the same time, India struggles because it does not have energy access. 400 million people do not not have electricity access in India. So how India chooses to bring power to these people will not only have implications domestically, but also globally.
Well, in fact, you are looking to bring solar power to areas that are right now in the dark. But the observation has been made that this is terrific, you know, solar energy coming to India. But it's people largely moving from no energy to solar energy, not people moving off fossil fuels. And you know that Americans can get kind of resistant to doing a lot of change until these behemoths that are just starting up their use of fossil fuels in some ways, India and China, until they do something.
Yeah, and I think it's very important to understand, and I think about myself trying to be a bridge between two countries, what it's like to understand the other side. And, you know, my own ancestral village on the outskirts of Jodhpur, Rajasthan, we only recently received electricity access. I just went back there recently. And before we had that, people had purchased solar panels. And so I think people need to understand, you know, what that number is of people that are living in the dark and what it means to come out of that kind of energy poverty, and then what it means for us to point the finger from this side and ask for more when there's so little already existing. And at the same time, when we get to these international climate negotiations and there is a constant call for more funds for the developing countries, I think it's also important to understand that even from a diplomatic perspective, we are constrained politically here in the United States by what is feasible and how much more can we squeeze at this time when the right policies aren't in place to allow the flow of capital for the needs of the global south.
Well, meanwhile, so we have this meeting of heads of state on Tuesday. It is part of a build-up to the meeting in Peru in a few months and then Paris next year. Outline how important those are.
I think we need to keep the momentum going, and that's the primary purpose of this summit. Unless we build that momentum, we may not arrive in Paris by 2015 with a workable document that negotiators can get to work on and finalize. And so that is what this summit will do, is hopefully have political declarations that are ambitious. So there might be some surprises. There might not be many surprises from some of the bigger players. And then Peru will certainly have to deliver in terms of finalizing the working pieces before Paris.
That's Karthike Singh, researcher with the Center for International Environment and Resource Policy at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.